Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Did you catch the Illinois GOP Gov debate on ABC 7 last night? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Take your calls on who you think performed well, what were the memorable lines, where you think the race stands, all of the above. Also, Amy could use a helping hand with formulating questions for the governor's debate that we're hosting.
Yep. June 23rd, and just so you know, we are not going to be testing prior to the debate. Part of the debate last night for Channel 7.
Testing for COVID,
yes. They had a specific PCR test that was mailed to each candidate that they had to take 2 days before the race, okay? And then they mailed it in. They did the debate. And Jesse Sullivan came back positive. Jesse Sullivan's fine. He's healthy.
So he did he had the max headroom slot.
Exactly,
for the debate,
but
it was fine. Actually, I thought he was fine. I thought he
held his own, but he could have done so much better in person.
Job.
So much better in person. But the big winner last night, I think, was Darren Bailey, because he took a lot of heat for saying Chicago's a hellhole. Even though we all know it's a hellhole, but people still live here. But last night, he did a better job handling it.
Chicago's a great city. And we've got to restore it. But interestingly enough, a week ago, you probably heard me refer to it as a hellhole. And you want to know what happened within hours after I made that statement? A homeless man was burned alive, and he's fighting for his life today. You've already heard what happened this past weekend. Mayor Lightfoot, Governor Pritzker, Kim Fox, and their woke anti-police policies, they are responsible for this. And if we are going to restore Chicago, somebody's got to tell the truth. I said it. And when I'm elected as governor, I'll fix the problem, and we will restore the greatness to Chicago.
He was just much more assertive last night, and I thought he was the big winner.
The debate started with, of course, a conversation about the mass shootings of the last couple of weeks, and specifically on school safety. And I think more or less there was agreement among the candidates on what's to be done and what isn't to be done. Gary Rabine had a nice summary of the various measures the state can take to help localities harden schools.
You know, many, many solutions, in my opinion, and we need to look at all of them. You know, armed officers, of course. You know, one way in, a secured way in, of course. When you look at metal detectors, a solution. When we look at advanced concealed carry training for teachers that want it, I think is a great idea. To have instead of gun-free zone, how about advanced concealed carry zone, where a person with a gun doesn't know. If somebody's trying to do bad things to our kids, they don't know if 10% or 80% of the teachers are armed.
Well, and that specifically is something I wanted to touch upon because it requires more discussion than 45-second answers can provide in the context of debate like last night. And I understand the limitations because you have an hour and you've got six candidates. But in Ohio, there is a bill that has moved to Governor DeWine's desk that would allow education staff to carry guns in schools with reduced training. The House bill in the state of Ohio allows any adult in a public or private school to carry a concealed firearm in a school safety zone if a district chooses to do so without the otherwise required 737 hours of peace officer training. What do you think about that? Just zeroing in on that specifically, and we can pull back and talk about the other issues tackled in the debate and the politics of it. But we've discussed this before. It's been moved in some states, the idea of allowing people who want to be armed in school, whether it's administrative staff or teachers, to do so. And then this measure in Ohio that would treat teachers in a school setting the way that you would teach a law-abiding citizen in a private setting, which is you get a concealed carry permit and you can carry in the school. You don't have to be treated like a police officer.
Yeah, and there's some rural areas of Ohio similar to the rural area of Uvalde, Texas, where help isn't going to be there right away, where you have police departments where you only have four or five officers. Also, teachers who carry, they'll also need up to 24 hours of initial training, then up to 8 hours of requalification training every year. I think it's a great idea. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know, and of course, this is also one of those conversations where you have to have some faith in people, because deferring everything to the government
doesn't work.
Well,
we did that for 2 years with COVID.
It also requires the reminder that those are just other people. So who is most incentivized to be the most proficient and safe with a firearm in a school? A teacher? An administrator? Yeah. Yeah, they are. And so you're either going to have a teacher who's experienced with guns and has a concealed carry permit under, you know, laws like Illinois, where you have to do 15 hours and it's half classroom and half range. And it's actually very simple. You don't need to be that very experienced at all to pass that course, which is fine. But you're either going to have somebody who's proficient and safe with a gun because they're experienced around guns, or you're going to have somebody that says, I want to become proficient and safe around guns because I want to be the front line of defending my students and the remote chance that something awful would transpire in my school.
Yeah, and I think even if you have police, they might not come in right away like they didn't in Uvalde.
Well, of course, but I think you have to, the more training, you have to treat them like a cop in terms of the required training. Why? The incentives are perfectly aligned between the adults in school, in addition to a school resource officer, obviously, if that person is on site, and the parents and the kids who rely on that school to be a safe environment, which is why I thought it would be nice. I know you want to get to as many topics as possible, but I thought it would be nice to allow a little bit more time for a specific proposal, somebody develop a specific proposal if they wanted. I guess they could have gone back and done that, but they didn't. But anyway, I'm glad it was raised yesterday. And of course, this is not new. It's been raised before. It's been implemented in some states, but it's going to be received as new by so many people, and it certainly would be a shock to the system if there was any traction gained in Illinois to do something like this. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Always good to hear your commentary. My big takeaway was hearing Irwin speak and evasive of the questions, his emphasis on how he's getting the support from the police, and the fact that Bailey tried to take him on and with regards to being the Democratic nominee.
Yeah, we'll get to Mr. Irvin. Thanks.
I love the exchange between Gary Rabine and Irvin, and Irvin started laughing. And that when it came to about how his safe is the sixth safest city in America. Bull jive.
Brian in St. John, Indiana.
Hey, good morning. Happy Friday. I just wanted to say I agree with you on the guns in the schools with teachers. I appreciate what Ohio's doing in terms of moving forward with this. I hope Indiana does something in 2024, because I don't hope it won't, but hopefully the new candidate will. And nonetheless, the proper training, the proper background check, it'll make the world a safer place. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Dawn, Crystal Lake.
Yes, good morning. I did not watch the gubernatorial debate. I, at this point, have no intention of voting Republican during the general election so far. I'm not impressed with the erosion of women's rights and the enshrinement of misogyny by the various Republican parties around the country.
How are they infringing on your rights? What does that mean?
Well, as a rape victim who was impregnated and gave birth to a daughter, and then had my daughter abducted by the man who had raped me, and then had courts award custody of my daughter to the man who had raped me and then ordered me to pay child support to him, despite the fact that my neck was broken in the effort to try to prevent the child abduction. I know what women go through. That's why I am an NRA member. I support the right for women to be able to blow the balls off of a rapist. And I'm very unhappy with the alliance between white nationalists and Catholics who intend to undermine the ability to women to be able to defend themselves.
Okay, Dawn, thanks for the call. I don't know what you're talking about. How is it the Republican, I mean, I don't know what to say other than the Republican position is for right to carry everywhere and has been for decades, which is why we have right to carry in this country writ large now, is because of conservatives who pushed for Second Amendment to be properly understood, as it now is, thanks to Supreme Court jurisprudence, as an individual right. Who is undermining the right for an individual to defend themselves, Republicans or Democrats? You just had a speech from the President of the United States yesterday reintroducing gun bans. I'm just baffled by the conclusion you draw about what you see on the landscape. Mark and Rochelle.
Yeah, if Pritzker is part of this debate that you're hosting, I would like him to answer the question.
Hilarious.
How he plans on balancing the budget without the $650 billion or whatever he got for COVID relief, because he claims he balanced the budget and stuff, and I'm so tired of that claim when he was given all that money.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, you're right. Thanks for the call, Mark. That'll be a good question and a good issue to bat around in a general election when the Republican Party decides who their nominee is. I don't believe Pritzker has offered to debate, participate in our debate.
This is just a Republican debate.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we were talking about the last night's ABC 7 Illinois GOP gubernatorial debate between the six candidates. Wanted to get into some of the moments where there was a little bit of back and forth between the two candidates, because those are usually some of the best moments, the most telling moments in a debate. And unfortunately, because of the way these debates, most of these debates are structured,
right,
you don't get much of that. But there was some of that yesterday because some of the candidates smartly took their time to go after
the Democrat in the room.
Well, and also Bailey was gone after, too. Whoever they think is the front runner, that's who you go after, or front runners in this case with Bailey and Irvin in a statistical dead heat. And so that's what happened. Rabin went after Irvin on crime stats in Aurora. That went like this.
There's nobody else here running that's freed up rapists as well as white beaters, okay? And when we look at Aurora, I saw a 40% increase in your city, 40% increase in crime over your leadership. That, I don't call that leadership and really caring about our police and crime. I can't see how you're going to govern a state that way.
And you know where those numbers came from? The Aurora Police Department. That's where those numbers came from. And he's sitting there laughing like a child. I mean, he got destroyed yesterday yet again. Because in the first debate, Marianne Ahern took him to task on every question that he answered. That didn't happen yesterday, but the candidates did it themselves.
So Rabin hit him on crime. I mean, you know, if you talk to people in Aurora, as I have, what they'll tell you is, you know, Aurora, what happened during the summer of 2020, the riots there, that happened on Irvin's watch. That was his fault.
Yeah, because he had a stand down order exactly like Mayor Lightfoot had.
But prior to Irvin's arrival, over the last 15 years, you've seen a lot of progress in terms of improving public safety in Aurora that he's taking credit for or attempting to take credit for. And then over the last 3 years, as you've had identitarian politicians, which include Richard Ervin, turn over their communities to identitarian hustlers and rioters and looters, you've seen crime stats, or you've seen the incidence of violent crime increase. And so that's happened in Aurora, you know, spikes year over year. There are differences. And also, you're pulling from a small number. It's not like we're talking about 800 murders in Chicago.
Right.
I mean, I don't mean to be dismissive of this, but just in terms of statistics, you know, you go from 4 murders to 6 murders. That's a 50% increase. You go from 4 murders to 2 murders. That's a 100% decrease. It sort of belies what's actually happening when you're dealing with smaller numbers in a smaller community like Aurora is. I know it's the second largest city in the state, but it's still only a city of 200,000 people. Ervin is sort of holding himself out like he's the mayor of a major metropolitan area,
right,
like our major city. That's just not the case, okay? So that was one exchange. I thought Bailey taking the opportunity to go after Ervin on taxes was good. And not just Ervin, but also his running mate. And this is important because his running mate is in the General Assembly. So she has a record, just as Ervin has a record as mayor.
Well, as Mayor Ervin was increasing the gas tax by 2 cents in the city of Aurora, and his counterpart, Avery Bourne, doubled your gas tax, I was standing up in the state legislature and fighting against all this nonsense. We certainly have a problem, and it is destroying our families. It's destroying our business when people can drive across state lines and fuel up and save money and shop and eat out. And we've got to stop this nonsense. So a zero-based budget, starting at ground zero, rebuilding, getting the fat out of our budget. Friends, I've seen it for 4 years. The waste in our budget is immense, and it's going to lead to a restoration when we weed it out and rebuild the budget so that you understand it.
Yeah, I think it was important to mention that. See, Avery Bourne is a creature of the Surrender Republicans super minority operation in Springfield. And so when Durkin needed to put safe Republicans on Pritzker's doubling of the state gas tax, Avery Bourne, you have to be one of the Republicans to take the hit. And so she did. And that tells you everything you need to know about Ervin and Bourne and who's backing them. And as a couple of the candidates mentioned, why this state is the worst governed state in America, not just a failure of those in charge, but a failure of those who actually don't want to be in charge. That would be the Republican, the establishment Republicans.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Jesse Sullivan, try to hit, you know, working remotely, try to get involved and call out Ervin.
I'm going to reduce the budget by $10 billion.
No, that's not it.
No, day one.
Well,
money cannot.
This is it.
Well, money cannot buy you character.
Money can't buy you character.
Money cannot buy you a conservative record. And when it comes to governor, I'm going to run as governor to do 3 things. Number one, I will do executive orders on day one, in the mask mandates, in the vaccine mandates, change out the boards, the Illinois State Board of Education.
I love it. Change out the boards. And Darren Bailey said pretty much the same thing.
So let's stick on taxes here for a second, because following Bailey's hit on Ervin on taxes, then Rabin jumped in, too. And Rabin was more aggressive last night, and he was better than in the first debate. Bailey was better than he was in the first debate, too, in my estimation. But Rabin had a good riff both on Ervin's record on property taxes, since he touts himself now as this, you know, with the shears that he's going to cut taxes in his commercials. And then Rabin turned to talk about property taxes specifically, and I thought both moments were good for him.
Yeah, I ask everybody to look this up because Cranes, about less than a year ago, had the highest tax city for property tax in the country, Aurora, Illinois. So I would beg to differ. Unless they're wrong, you should look at that.
They're wrong.
Okay?
They're not wrong. It's not Cranes. It's the Lincoln Land Institute, and they looked at 73 mid-sized cities in the country, and Aurora was number one with a bullet. Highest property taxes, north of 4% of property tax rate as a percentage of home value, which, of course, is confiscatory. And now, again, to be fair, because I am, the majority of your property tax is driven by schools.
Right. And what are you getting?
Not municipal government. And the school district is not under the direction of Richard Irvin. So the municipality has a small role in your overall property tax bill. With that being said, don't run around and tell me that they're wrong, as Irvin did last night, because they're not wrong. They're not wrong on the data. And it shows you how dishonest he is or ignorant. Either way, it's a problem because he could explain to you the same thing I just explained to you. And you would say, oh, okay, well, that's fair. But that would undermine this idea that he is, you know, the new sheriff that came to town and cleaned up Aurora and made it Mayberry and reduced taxes. And he's going to do for Illinois what he did to Aurora. He's got those shears and he's going to cut your taxes. That's just codswallop.
I don't even want to play any of his bites from yesterday because it's all lies that come out of his mouth.
And here is, just on policy, was Rabine's best moment last night when he moved from mentioning what Aurora's status actually is when it comes to property taxes to talking about property taxes and what needs to be done.
I say this, forget about holding taxes or vetoing taxes, okay? We need to crush property taxes. I've been saying this from the very beginning. We need to crush property taxes to be the average of the country. The average of the country in a home pays 1% of the value in property tax. $200,000 home, $2,000. That's the average. Illinois is approaching $6,000 for that same house. That's highway robbery. We're going to stop it when I win. We're going to crush property taxes to the average of the country, 1% for commercial, 2% for...
Thank you, Mr. Schiff.
2% for commercial, sir.
Yeah,
he was spot on.
He misspoke at the end, but he's where I've been for a lot longer, a decade. 1% hard cap on residential property taxes as a percentage of a home value, 2% for commercial, which is Gary's position. He just flipped the numbers there at the end. And it's also Darren Bailey's position, by the way. And a hard cap, the only way your property taxes go up is if you have a capital event. You either improve the home or you sell the home. This is what Indiana has. This is what California has.
This, guys. Come on.
And this is how you restore people's home values to them. You restore the possibility of a return on investment on your home in Illinois. So it was good that Rabine brought it up, and I thought he was very succinct on the topic. Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. You want to know why Illinois is the worst governed state in the union? Look no further than that woman who just called you talking about losing her women's right to choose and white nationalism and all that other nonsense. And sadly, those are the people that Republicans in this state keep pandering to, confused women in the suburbs who don't know what they're talking about. But one last thing I wanted to say about Irvin. I keep seeing these ads the last couple days. I don't know if you guys have seen them where he's endorsed by all these top law enforcement people, you know, the FOP guys and stuff. But and it's all these, like, alpha male-looking white guys, guys with beards, you know, tough-talking guys. And, you know, Richard Irvin's got our back. He's law and order. He's going to clean the streets up. And it just irritates me that those are the kind of people that are endorsing this guy. When you look at his actual record, it just makes my view of law enforcement in this state even lower. And shame on them because they know better.
Well, thanks for the call, Mike. I mean, it's a fair point you raise. A lot of the law enforcement, these are the politician law enforcement people, not the rank and file law enforcement people. There's a big difference, as we know. And I think a lot of those people... You know, Richard Irvin is blah, 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 blah. Thank you very much, Sheriff or Officer or whoever. Now, who do I make that check out to?
Exactly. And then we know some politicians. Well, people in law enforcement that are going to become politicians and want to get snuggly with Ken Griffin's money.
Right.
And that's fraught with danger, too. But just there's other motives, folks. Just look into them.
Imagine other motives in Illinois politics other than altruism. Can you believe it? Another important moment here. Some of these exchanges we want to get to. Bailey turning to Irvin, taking the time to call him out directly, since this is perhaps one of the few times they'll be on stage together, at least with an audience. This is how that went.
I just want to take this time, Mr. Ervin, to address you something. I'm glad you're here tonight because I want to let you know something. I'm not interested in defeating you just because you're a Democrat. I'm interested in defeating you because you are a corrupt Democrat, and your pay-to-play politics in the city of Aurora that have led to all this nonsense, taking from taxpayers and giving to people that support you, it's nonsense.
I need to bring you back.
I need to bring you back. Alan, let him talk. Come on. Let's duke it out because, you know, this is the last debate before the primary. We've offered Ervin's people.
With all of them because Ervin won't do ours.
Right, but everyone's committed except for Richard Ervin. And, you know, if he wants to be a Republican governor, he should go on to a debate at a Republican station. So he had, that was his one chance last night. Hmm. And I thought he was very effective.
And Bailey made a sort of built on that moment a little bit later on the debate. And you also heard Sullivan pick up on that bite that you played, Money Can't Buy Character. That was a hit on Ervin and the Illinois Combine Republicans. Bailey picked up on that, too, saying this.
So we certainly have a failure of Republican leadership here in the state of Illinois, and I believe that's what's got us in the superminority. So we look back and we see the failures of the last administration. I've said from the beginning of this race that the worst thing, rather than having J.B. Pritzker serve four more years, would be to have the wrong Republican in office. And now we have that possibility before us. So we have got to stand up. We've got the answers with our platform, and we need a Republican governor who's actually going to tell the truth.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. The enemy inside the perimeter argument. And if people didn't learn the lesson of the enemy inside the perimeter with the Bruce Rauner years, well, then shame on you. And shame on us for what we've allowed the Republican Party to become, and by extension the state, I suppose. Shame on everybody. The Rauner experience should be still fresh in the minds of most adults. And it wasn't just abortion. It was in every policy area. Sanctuary state, income tax increase. And he was the guy, just like Richard Ervin, saying, you know, I'm going to cut your taxes. I mean, he was even in a sort of a better position because he wasn't some hack mayor that had increased taxes. He was an outside, you know, he was a businessman outsider who had no political policy record. And so he was seen as
about social issues,
and he was independently wealthy. So if they're like, yeah, he can just take it to whoever because he doesn't need anybody's money. He's not looking to leverage public office for private gain. And this is his bailiwick, right? He's made a kajillion dollars as a private equity guy. He knows how to make balance sheets work. He knows how to grow an economy like we grow a business. But the problem is he didn't have the character. That was the problem.
And now we have tax-funded payer abortions, and we still have that.
And once you pull that thread, it all comes apart, doesn't it? Which is why the other exchange I want to get to is about abortion.
Oh, yeah.
And the prospect of Roe being overturned before the month is out. And again, Ervin offering this really curious reply that he stuck to for the last many weeks, that somehow he and his puppet masters think would help him if he were to get to a general election. All this answer does is ensure that you stand in the middle of the road and get hit by traffic going both ways, but
It's the same answer. Let's hear it again.
This is what he said.
Again.
And Mr. Ervin, it's your chance for a rebuttal, and you've heard some people here bringing up your name on this issue.
You know, I know many of my opponents here on the stage are attacking me, and I understand. And I get it. You know, they're threatened by the fact that I'm violating their political aspirations, and I'm hurting their political aspirations. Let me tell you why I'm Republican. My grandfather talked.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. This was after he had answered, and then he was challenged. By the way, everybody on stage is violating everybody, violating whatever that means, violating everybody else's political ambitions. I mean, I don't, that argument doesn't make any sense. But here was his dodge on Dobbs.
You know, I'm pro-life, but you know, as a lawyer and as a former prosecutor, I think it's irresponsible to comment and hypothesize on a leaked draft of the Supreme Court decision that hasn't even come down yet. Once
what
we get,
would you do,
once,
though?
Once, once,
we're
once,
not asking
once,
your opinion
once
on
we
that.
Get that, once we get the final draft.
I mean, it's the same thing. He's trying to string everybody along until he hopefully wins the general election. We know what his position is.
No, it doesn't matter. No, you know what his position is.
Yeah.
By that quality of that answer. What do you think? He's pretending not to be pro-life so he can come out as pro-life? That never happens.
He's
That's not what's
pro-life.
Happening.
He wants Illinois to still be an abortion capital of the world.
But it makes no sense. He's going to get hit from the left by being not pro-abortion enough. It's also a political malpractice in addition to a demonstration of no character. Here's how a pro-lifer actually talks. And I'm not talking – you're not going to hear from Darren Bailey on this one, although you did hear from Darren Bailey on this. He's the one endorsed by all the pro-life groups. But Max Solomon, who most people don't know, other than maybe if you've watched these debates, he's like a 50-year-old attorney.
From Hazelcrest.
By way of Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And
He's good.
Yeah, I like him too.
He's growing on me.
Listen, you heard Irvin's answer. Like, I'm not going to comment. Well, what would you do? I mean, this is, you know, we're looking prospectively at what kind of governor you would be. The idea. I don't tackle hypotheticals. You tackle all sorts of hypotheticals. You just won't tackle this one. Yeah. It's just so dishonest. But that's an indication of how slithery Irvin is. Now compare that answer you heard from Irvin to Max Solomon.
I am unapologetically and uncompromisingly pro-life. I actually believe that every life has a purpose, regardless of how they're conceived. Therefore, it's my prayer that Roe v. Wade be overturned. And as governor of the state of Illinois, when Roe v. Wade is overturned, I will make sure two things. Not a single dollar, not a single cent of taxpayers' money would go towards abortion or the funding of any organization that supports abortion. And number two, it'll be my priority to make sure that Illinois is an abortion-free state.
Whether you agree with Max Solomon or not, that is someone that is giving you their authentic
self.
And thoughtful, he's thought through this issue,
mm-hmm.
authentic and thoughtful response on topic. Greg in Rogers Park.
Hi, good morning, guys. I really appreciate your show. You guys are a beacon of hope in this bad state right now. My question to you guys is this. Let's say that Bailey wins or whatever. Our state's going to have terrible financial problems. We're broke. I don't care what Pritzker says. We borrowed money. We owe so much in liabilities. We, our bond ratings are still terrible. Do you think we have a shot at getting us legislators in there to at least get responsible fiscal leaderships in the state where, I mean, where we cut programs and cut spending and really do a balanced budget, the real one? Thanks. I appreciate you guys.
Thanks for the call, Greg. That's a good question. I would say no, not this cycle. Despite it being as good a cycle as it portends to be, unfortunately, the House and Senate Republicans are so inept, so incompetent, so lacking in courage that they won't be able to take advantage of it. Barring something like Darren Bailey as the nominee leading a revolt into the general election that occurs within the Republican Party as well as the state more generally, then maybe you could see, I don't hold out much hope that you go from super minority to majority this year, but you can narrow the gap and make it a little bit easier to build coalitions around particular issues with the handful of Southern Illinois Democrats that are central and Southern Illinois Democrats that are left. Maybe. But this is a multi-year, perhaps multi-generation reclamation project. This is not going to happen in November, no matter who, even if everything goes right, Bailey's their nominee and Bailey beats Pritzker. You have to think about this over several cycles at least, because how many cycles did it take for us to get to this place of the worst governed state in American history?
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the big guy addressed the nation on guns last evening. But before he addressed the nation, KJP Karine Jean-Pierre addressed the D.C. press corps. The triple, she's the quadruple threat.
Quadruple, yeah, please. She's got we have a triple threat here, the quadruple.
She's got the immigrant kicker.
Black, female, gay.
Immigrant. She's got the immigrant kicker on Lightfoot. Yeah, that's right. Karine Jean-Pierre on the nature of the speech, what it was going to be last night. It, you know, no partisan politics.
So this is not about politics. This is not about partisan politics here. This is something that he has worked on since he was a senator. This is very important and real for the president and for the grieving families.
Not going to be about partisan politics. And then we got this last night from the big guy.
But after Republicans let the law expire in 2004, and those weapons were allowed to be sold again, mass shootings tripled. Those are the facts.
He continues to repeat lies because that's what he's been doing for 50 years. That's all he knows. He's a fabulous.
He lies so much he's believing in it.
No, he's also a bad person. He's a preternaturally dishonest person. And he's a dumb person. And being dishonest and dumb is a bad combination. You can be dishonest and smart and you can get away with some stuff. Being dishonest and dumb, can't get away with much, even though we're talking about the occupant of the White House. That's just a lottery ticket that he punched by surviving for 50 years in D.C. Just on point of order on that, those are just the facts. Anytime the big guy says those are just the facts, you know that those are the anti-facts.
Sounds like Pritzker. It's just facts. What's a fact? Oh, okay.
This has perhaps become droll for the listeners because we've had to repeat it so many times. James Allen Fox is a noted Northeastern University professor who collects data on mass shootings. He's collected data back to 1982. Assault weapons account for about 24.6% of public mass shootings since 82. That would leave handguns accounting for twice as many mass shootings, you know, being used in twice as many mass shootings as so-called assault weapons that he wants to ban again, the big guy. Also, before the gun ban, the assault weapon gun ban, 94 to 2005, after. During the ban and after. Just, I'll give you the 40-year history here, or 30-year history, actually, and from James Allen Fox, the Northeastern University professor. 76 to 94, 18 mass shootings occurred each year. During the ban, 94 to 2005, 95 to 2004, I should say, 19 incidents, ticked up by one over the previous 18 years. During the ban.
So it's similar to Chicago's 25-year gun ban we had here.
After the ban, the average went up from 06 to 2011 to 21 a year. Not statistically significant. 18 for the 18 years prior, 19 for the 9 years during, 10 years during, and then 21 for the 6 or 7 years following with respect to the data collection that was done. It tends to indicate that the key variable has nothing to do with instrumentality. Also this, just so we get the facts. Well, let's look at the data since we're talking about these wonderful politicians of data and science. Again, here, the studies, the National Institute of Justice, within the Department of Justice, their initial report on the assault weapon ban, among other things, The ban has failed to reduce the average number of victims per gun murder incident or multiple gunshot wound victims. Was also a little bit early, or so there was not necessary data. There's no indication that it was doing anything other than impacting the price of these weapons that were banned. Some of these scary looking rifles that were banned because they were scary looking enough to, I guess, encourage politicians to ban them. Criminal use of the banned guns declined, at least temporarily, after the law went into effect, which suggests that the legal stock of pre-ban assault weapons was, at least for the short term, largely in the hands of collectors and dealers. Boy, what a surprise that is. Mm-hmm. It just didn't have any significant impact. And if we were to go down this path again, including the proposal to raise the age from 18 to 21 for sport rifles or some sport rifles, there's just no reason to believe it's going to have any impact in improving public safety or preventing mass shootings.
Well, I have an 18-year-old in my house, and I would not want them to have an assault weapon at this young age.
Yeah, well,
I think 21 would be reasonable. So, no, it push back against me. I don't care. 312-642-5600, turnkey dot pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
There go our feelings again. I get it.
I live with one, and I would not want, and he's responsible. I mean, he's a wonderful citizen, wonderful human being. I just wouldn't.
What you want and what should be the law are two different discussions.
Right, and he can go out. He's 18 years old, and he can do whatever he wants.
What about joining the military? Should that be 18 or 21?
That 18. So if you're in the military, right, but that's you're in the military. You're being trained professionally to use an assault weapon.
So you can only use it in a military setting. If you're an 18-year-old who's enlisted, you can't have you can't own a sport rifle privately?
You wouldn't need a sport rifle. We're not hunting out here.
I'm not talking about your son. I'm talking, since you're talking about a law for 330 million people, mm-hmm. if you could get beyond your household.
Right.
So what is it? Can somebody who's enlisted in the military at 18 then own a sport rifle privately? Or do they only get to use it when they're in the military?
They only get to use it when they're in the military. Mm-hmm. And extended magazines, not a fan of those. Point in case, Jared Loughner, when the only time my friend Steve, because, yes, they were on the show. They came on after the Gabby Gifford shooting. Because they're gun owners, responsible gun owners. And they knew when he was changing out his magazine clip, that's when they pounced on him to stop him. And if not, he had 30 rounds ready to go in an extended clip that he was trying to get in there to his gun. And who knows how many others would have died.
Yeah. You sound a lot like the big guy yesterday telling us how much he respects law-abiding gun owners.
I want to be very clear. This is not about taking away anyone's guns. It's about not about vilifying gun owners.
Of course not.
In fact, we believe we should be treating responsible gun owners as an example of how every gun owner should behave. I respect the culture and the tradition and the concerns of lawful gun owners. At the same time, the Second Amendment, like all other rights, is not absolute. It was Justice Scalia who wrote, and I quote, like most rights, the rights granted by the Second Amendment are not unlimited.
Yeah. The layers of sophistry there. Let's unpack them, shall we? Number one, is respecting law-abiding gun owners demagoguing them with the boogeyman phrase gun lobby? Is that what's respectful? The gun lobby did this. The gun lobby prevented that. The gun lobby has blood on their hands. Who's the gun lobby? You mean the couple million Americans that belong to the NRA or other gun enthusiast advocacy organizations? Gun Owners of America, etc. Is that respecting them? If we don't refer to them individually, we pretend that the law-abiding gun owners who are members of the NRA are not the gun lobby. The NRA wouldn't exist without the law-abiding gun owners who are members of the NRA. the gun lobby, that's respectful, believes in the culture. This is a guy who thinks a 9mm is nine millimeter bullets blow the lungs out of somebody's body. Get a shotgun, Joe Biden, if you recall that from his VP days. This guy knows nothing about a lot of things, including guns. And he and his party have zero respect for law-abiding gun owners. That's why they want to punish law-abiding gun owners for the crimes of the non-law-abiding gun owners. That, by definition, is disrespectful. Is it not? Do I have that wrong? I respect you and the culture, however. And by the way, no one has suggested that the Second Amendment is an absolute right. The problem we have, big guy and fellow travelers, is that you don't believe, because you've said so, because you argued against Supreme Court decisions, including those in which Scalia weighed in, that defined the Second Amendment as an individual right. But you don't believe that. So don't tell me about constitutional jurisprudence and absolute rights when you won't even stipulate to current Supreme Court jurisprudence that it's an individual right. And you don't do that. And then you're going to turn around and tell me again, while you're refusing to acknowledge my individual rights under the Constitution, while you're attempting to take away guns I legally own as a law-abiding American, that you respect me and the gun culture and the right of self-defense and the right to protect oneself against tyrannical government. Speciousness from beginning to end from the big guy yesterday.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Dave, formerly of Elgin.
Hey, Amy, I just wanted to say that technically at the age of 18, your son basically is an assault weapon. When I was 18, your son's age, I was in the military and running around with fully loaded automatic weapons. Unlike the so-called assault weapons, the first one, assault weapon, was actually a rock.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Well, I mean, here again, the question becomes, if we're in the business of doing whatever it takes to save lives, then the rank order priority, twice as many handguns used, semi-auto handguns used in mass shootings as semi-auto rifles.
Right, but six of the nine deadliest mass shootings in the U.S. were people who were 21 or younger. Buffalo, New York, he was 18. This guy in Uvalde, this monster, just turned 18, was able to buy weapons, which he shouldn't have been able to buy anyway because he's mentally deranged.
No,
but there was no record of it,
and
that's the problem.
And so I'm confused. So then should we raise the age of 21 to 21 for handguns as well?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
We
why
should.
Not?
Okay. Handguns, yes, 21. Fred and Hammond, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah. You know, Amy, I'm just wondering, would you have a problem with your 18-year-old having a 9mm pistol? Because the rate of fire is identical to the AR. Pull the trigger, every time you pull, it shoots.
Yeah, that's
You can buy a 30-round magazine for a 9mm. I used to work at a sporting goods store. You'd be surprised how many guys are coming in looking for 40 and 50 round magazines for their handguns.
Okay, why? But why do you need that kind of power? Just help me. Walk me through that.
Well, your guys on the south side of Chicago, their accuracy is so great that they have to, you know, instead of one shot, one kill, they have to shoot multiple bullets. You know,
well, then shouldn't we not be selling those if that's the purpose of the extended clip or magazine?
That's really not the purpose. There are guys who go out and they go out and shoot targets, and instead of reloading a magazine two or three times, they would rather shoot out, you know, 10 or 20 rounds at a time. some of your my personal carry has a magazine that holds 17 rounds, and I keep it loaded all the time with hollow points. Another thing, basically any semi-automatic weapon that you have has the same rate of fire as an AR-15. Pull the trigger as fast as you can.
Thanks for the call.
Pull the trigger and shoot 30 rounds. So.
Thanks for the call, Fred. So 6 of the 9 of the worst mass shootings.
Since 2018.
Since 2018.
For people who are 21 or younger.
Yeah, so this is fun to cherry pick data. Let's continue cherry picking. How many were over 21 but under 25? Can we get that data? How many mass shooters do you think since Charles Whitman at the University of Texas, how many do you think were under the age of 35? All of them? Not all. 90%? So if
it says before 2000 were most often initiated by men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah, okay. So why don't we just ban ownership of sport rifles and handguns for anybody under 50?
I just say 18-year-olds, it's way too young. They're not mature enough.
Maybe for your 18-year-old. This idea we group. All these groupings that we do, arbitrary as they are, and that's what they are, arbitrary. Well, we know men under the age of 30 commit most of the crimes.
Yeah, there's two clusters, this New York Times article.
Mm-hmm.
But two clusters when it comes to mass shooters, people in their 40s who commit workplace-type shootings, and a very big cluster of young people, 18, 19, 20, 21, who seem to get caught up in the social contagion of killing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just think
that's from the Violence Project.
If you eliminate gun ownership for everybody, men under 50, I think you got your problem solved, it sounds like. Right? And I also, questions that are predicated on need. Why do I need to say what I say? Well, I don't need to say it. I choose to say it because it's my individual right to say it. Need suggests that I have to petition or that there needs to be some explanation I give to the public for the exercise of my right. No, that's not how the exercise of rights works. It exists equally and simultaneously among all of us. So understand the difference between a right and a privilege, between the exercise of a right and having to justify exercising your right as some sort of meet some sort of need threshold according to, I don't know, popular opinion. I feel this. Why do you need that? All the wrong questions and the wrong disposition to make public policy, of course. And once you start feeling, when do you stop? Why 21? By the way, you can vote at 18. Should that be raised to 21 too? So I can vote on politicians who will make public policy that impact me at 18, but I can't exercise my other rights? Individual rights enshrined in the Constitution? Like my right
can't
of self-protection.
Buy cigarettes in Illinois.
That's not a constitutional
21?
Right. No. Right of self-protection is, where's the right to buy cigarettes in the Constitution? I know where the right to defend yourself is, and I know it's an individual right. What can you point to? So if I can vote at 18, I can't own a gun at 18. I can join the military at 18. I can serve my country. I could die for my country. I can't own a gun as a private citizen. Should we make everything 21? Everything 25, everything 50. What's the magic age? Where do my constitutional rights kick in? Verlon on the South Side.
I want to say it's total hypocrisy to say it's only okay for an 18-year-old to enlist and hold real military weapons and use them, and can't use an average weapon in his personal life. Then you might as well raise the age to enlist to 21, since an 18-year-old isn't responsible. And you might as well raise everything to 21 and say you're not an adult until you're 21 if you can't own and protect yourself and your family at the age of 18. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Verlon. How many 21 – what's the percentage of 21-year-olds that act more adult-like than 18-year-olds? Do we have data on that? Of course we don't. 21 is an adult? Really? Have you been on a college campus lately? 21 is an adult for some people who behave like adults. 18 is too. So 16. We know. We know what the magic ages are. We know where to draw the lines. Government is so good at that. Jordan, Forest Park.
You know, the president was talking about limiting high-capacity magazines. I was shocked that he didn't bring up the success story of Chicago in Cook County, where they've had a 10-round magazine limit for a number of years now. You know, very surprising about that.
It's going
and
well.
Also, I'd also like to answer the question about who would need an AR-15? Well, I'll tell you what, if some of these flash mobs that have started in the retail sections of various cities, if those move into some of the suburbs, you're on your own. And you know, your 9mm handgun probably ain't going to be enough.
All right, Jordan.
Well, according to the Giffords Law
please.
Center. Well, no, in Illinois, you have to be 21 years of age to obtain a FOID card. You can buy a handgun and an assault rifle at the age of 18, but you can't buy a gun unless you have a FOID card. See what I'm saying? So that's unless you have a handwritten consent by his or her parent or legal guardian to possess and acquire the firearm and ammunition.
So?
So you have to be 21 years of age in Illinois to buy a handgun or an assault rifle. Unless you have a written consent by your mom or dad or guardian.
And your point is what?
I'm just saying that there's a law already in place now where you can't buy a handgun or an assault rifle until you're 21 because you have to have a FOID card. You cannot get a FOID card in Illinois unless you're 21.
Uh-huh. And the question is not what the law is. The question is that good law? We have four states. Did we talk about this yesterday? Four states have FOID cards. 46 do not.
Hawaii.
And you have Republican gubernatorial candidates that want to eliminate the FOID card, except for Richard Irvin. And so you're saying because Illinois has a terrible law, we should make that national policy.
I'm just saying because people are texting and saying, you know, you can't buy a gun unless you're 21. And I just looked it up and they're right. Our listeners.
So what? Don't tell me what is. We're arguing about what should be.
I like the idea.
Right. So we have a terrible law in Illinois, and I can point to where terrible laws are. So there's a terrible law that exists somewhere. So my defense for it is say it exists, so let's make it national. That's an interesting argument. Not a particularly persuasive one, but it's interesting.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, you got to fight back. You have to fight back against the neo-Jacobins, the new Marxists, the purveyors of darkness and oppression. And if you do, sometimes you win. They're winning more than we are right now, I would say, based on where American culture stands at present. But there are some victories to celebrate. Our friend Ilya Shapiro, writing in the Wall Street Journal, "My cancel culture nightmare is over. Tomorrow, I assume my duties as a senior lecturer at Georgetown University Law Center and executive director of its Center for the Constitution."
Yep.
This after a four-month investigation by the Human Resources Department of the Office of Institutional Diversity, Equity, and Affirmative Action determined I wasn't yet an employee when I posted the tweet that got him in so much trouble.
And it was about the Supreme Court nominee.
Right. It was about KJB, Ketanji, or KBJ, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Which he agreed was like inartfully worded, but I mean the idea Ilya Shapiro is some racist is ridiculous and
totally ridiculous.
Runs afoul of his prodigious amount of scholarship. He writes, "What I achieved was a technical victory, but one that still shows the value in standing up for free speech in the face of cancellation. That so even when the speech is inartful, as I readily admitted, my criticism of President Biden's decision to limit his Supreme Court pool by race and sex." He writes, it's ironic that what got me adjudged a racist and misogynist by the illiberal mob was a tweet expressing opposition to hiring people based on race and sex. Yes, the irony is bound. Regardless, all are invited to my Georgetown events. It's a new day. No cancellation will happen at the hands of Ilya Shapiro at the Center for the Constitution at Georgetown University Law Center. So that's good news. We had him on the show to discuss when he was in the throes of it couple months back. Also, this out of Wisconsin, two sets of parents have filed a lawsuit against the Kettle Moraine School District, challenging its policy that allows minor students to change their name and gender pronouns at school without parental consent. The Waukesha County Circuit Court denied the school district's motion to dismiss, and so the lawsuit moves forward.
Yep, that's good news.
And so that brings us to this case that we mentioned, the case of Maggie DeJong, who's a recent graduate of the Masters of Art Therapy program at SIU, the Salukis. She was this is so odd. This is new for me that schools are doing this. In the program, they would discuss an array of topics, including religion, politics, critical race theory, COVID-19. Because Maggie DeJong's views often differ from those of the other students in the art therapy program at SIU, several of her fellow students reported her speech to university officials, of course.
My little snitches.
In February, SIU officials issued no contact orders against DeJong, prohibiting her from having any contact or even indirect communication with three fellow graduate students who complained that her expression of religious and political viewpoints constituted harassment and discrimination. They were talking about topics COVID-19, critical race theory, whatever, religion, politics, in a classroom setting. And the school is issuing restraining orders against its students because one student doesn't like the viewpoint of another student that's provided in a classroom.
And that's considered harassment and discrimination?
Right. And the university is the free marketplace of ideas, right? It hasn't been that for a long time. Joining us now, Maggie DeJong and her attorney, Greg Walters, who's senior counsel at the Alliance for Defending Freedom. Maggie, Greg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us on this morning.
You may have broader perspective on this. The idea of, de facto restraining orders issued by university officials against students, is that a new thing? Am I been asleep at the switch on this?
It's really, we're seeing it as a developing thing in the area of speech. You will see restraining orders on campuses concerning investigations of sexual assault,
right,
and those types of things, violence, threatened violence. But when it comes to speech that universities can allege, just claim it's harassing when it's nothing more than, quote, offensive speech to somebody else, this is becoming more and more prevalent. And the bottom line is that universities cannot censor students because of their religious or political views.
Well, I mean, the restraining order in a context of a sexual assault, that's a matter for law enforcement, not, the assistant provost, which is why they have to step in here with their own version of restraining orders, because, of course, this is not a police matter and it shouldn't be a university matter, as you point out. All right. So, well, Maggie, tell us what happened in class, how you offended these snowflakes that you were matriculating with.
Well, the thing is, this happened in class, in the classroom settings where we would have different conversations, but also conversations outside of class. So they had also, been watching my social media, and found that offensive as well. And so this is in class, but also outside of class. But what's concerning about this is universities should encourage diversity of thought, and it should be a marketplace of ideas, not an echo chamber for one ideology, particularly their ideology. And so what I experienced was that if you do go against the grain of the university worldview, you do experience backlash. And that was something that was very evident within my first year of that program.
Can you tell me, can you be specific or more specific what was said or what was on your social media that they found so offensive?
Yeah, so I think there were different examples, like you had mentioned earlier, where discussions on critical race theory, discussions on, postmodern theoretical frameworks and Marxism. But I think one very interesting instance that happened that regarded my faith was a girl who reached out to me because of a social media post that I posted about my faith. And she asked me about it, and I welcomed the dialogue. I was excited to actually have a conversation. But my response to her and her question was that my personal held beliefs are grounded in objective truth by the gospel of Jesus Christ. To later find that very quote that was in a private message on an art installation piece that they put in the department building, and the title of that piece was The Crushing Weight of Microaggressions. So that very quote was considered a microaggression.
Oh, do these people not have anything better to do with their time than complain about that? I mean, is that their calling card?
They're in the Masters of Art Therapy program at SIU, so the answer is probably no. No offense, Maggie. I'm just kidding. Having a little fun at your expense. Please don't report me to the assistant provost at SIU.
Oh, my goodness. So
you just explained to her basically the fundamental tenet of Christianity, and she's offended by that, and apparently so is the school.
Yeah. And what's sad is I didn't impose that on her. Like, it was just what grounds me. That is what directs my viewpoints, but that's not something I'm going to impose on these students.
Now, are you not telling us the whole story? Did you also, in class, did you promote slavery or white supremacy? Did you suggest that we should repeal women's right to vote or something like this? What were the discussions in class that had students looking askance at you?
Well, for sure, no to all of those. I think, honestly, the views that I brought up in class, or even questioning things, because I think that's something that's important within the academic setting, the views that I brought up, a lot of people in America hold. And so in them silencing me, they're silencing a lot of people, a lot of viewpoints in America that just hold very these basic views about, freedom of speech and, critical race theory, stuff like that. And so I think what's concerning is that this was not anything that was, straying from what many people in America think.
So how did you how did you find out that you had a restraining order against you? And did you go to class, and did they make you move away from these other students, or how did it go down?
That's a good question. I actually got an email with the no contact orders. And so there was nothing explaining why I got them. Like, there was no reason for them, no explanation for why I would be, these would be implemented. But yeah, I got them through an email.
And then were you able to continue in that class, or were you boxed out of it?
So within the classroom setting, I remained very quiet. It almost put an invisible muzzle on me, where I just had to be very quiet and not engage for fear of, getting trouble with the university.
Was there anybody else in class, or now that this story has become public, any other professor that had, including the professor in whatever class this occurred, that has rallied to your defense, or is just everybody just wants to tar and feather Maggie? That's where things are at.
Well, I think there's, in regard to students, there's a silent minority who have had who have supported me, who have, been there for me through the hard parts of this, but I was very much outnumbered.
But anybody publicly say what the university did to Maggie is wrong? Anybody say that?
It's a good question.
If you don't know the answer, I guess that's the answer. That's sort of a sad commentary. I mean, my experience when I was at Northwestern University, and there was an effort to kick our alternative campus paper off campus by the student government for our various crimes against humanity. You actually had, and we were conservatives. It was, you know, it was an independent paper, but it was conservative and editorial bent. And you had a bunch of the Medill professors write a letter saying this is wrong. You had Eric Zorn, of all people, a Chicago Tribune columnist at the time, write a letter defending our newspaper, the Northwestern Chronicle. To me, that's how things have changed over my time at college for 25 years ago to your time now. There's just nobody who, if they are intellectually honest, they are only privately so. There's just so few people willing to be publicly intellectually honest.
Mm.
Yeah. Sad.
Yeah. No, that's very sad.
What
I think there's fear. What is definitely going on.
Yeah, clearly. I'm glad that you're not afraid and you're not afraid to fight back along with your friends at the Alliance for Defending Freedom. So where does the case stand? What's next? Maybe this is a question for Greg.
Yeah. So right now we just filed the complaint on Tuesday this week, May 31st. So we go through the formality of serving the defendants that we've named. And from then it'll be within the next couple months. We'll see the position that the university officials take, whether they answer our complaint or more likely what happens in every civil case, the motions will start and we'll start battling it out on that front.
Yeah.
So it'll be a few months before things really get going.
And, you know, for all those listening, you know, Southern Illinois University, that's a taxpayer-supported state institution. Just a reminder there. And for legislators listening, that's a taxpayer-supported state institution. This is a matter for legislative involvement as well as citizen involvement, putting pressure on these new Marxists apparently in charge of SIU. I can't imagine this flies down in the greater Carbondale area generally, but on campus I know it's a different world. Maggie DeJong, recent graduate of the Masters of Art Therapy program at SIU, and her attorney Greg Walters from the Alliance for Defending Freedom. Maggie and Greg, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the complaint. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And they both joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
All right, listen up. On Sunday, June 12th, join AM 560 as we celebrate the sound, sights, and tastes of Jewish culture at the Great Chicago Jewish Festival. Experience song and dance, art, kids' activities, kosher food at the longest-running Jewish festival in America, folks. The Greater Chicago Jewish Festival is Sunday, June 12th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at St. Paul Woods in the Cook County Forest Preserve. Find all the details at jewishfestival.org. That's jewishfestival.org.
All right. Oak Park River Forest High School. Boy, we really struck a nerve along with West Cook News, which is part of a newspaper group I'm affiliated with for the umpteenth time. Really brought them out for a street fight. I'm talking about the Identitarians, the new Marxists that run Chicago media and obviously most all of the K-12 school systems in the region.
You kicked the hornet's nest here. You're on the front page of the Chicago Tribune.
It's great when they come out because normally they're allowed to exist in their silos. They don't have to fight it out in public view. And when they do, they're usually running roughshod over some surrender center rightist who leads with an apology. Well, that's not me, so I'm happy to have this conversation in public, and I appreciate everybody who's weighing in, including the people telling me to die and to eat excrement and so on and so forth. I appreciate it all because I want people to publicly demonstrate who they are just as I do, and then people can make their own form their own opinions on the topic and the people involved.
Did somebody tweet that to you that they want you to die?
Lots of stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Internet cowboys. Woo!
Yeah. I always invite them to call in on the show, to come in studio if they want to turn at the wheel. Let's do things in real time, you know, where nobody has a safety net. Nobody can hide in their mom's basement. But I rarely get anybody taking me up on my offers.
Throw out the number anyway. 312-642-5600, turnkey .pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So the story, just to set the baseline again, is that Oak Park River Forest is moving to formally impose something that they've announced they're going to do, something they've been slow walking and imposing in a de facto way, which is a race-based grading system. If you're a minority at Oak Park River Forest, you're not going to get marked off for things like misbehaving, not turning in homework, not showing up for class. And this has generated quite the vociferous response, including this Tribune story that Amy just referenced. False story on Oak Park and River Forest High School spreads online. It doesn't really talk so much about what's false. It just talks about me and the newspaper groups and Darren Bailey and who I'm supporting for governor and what was said by some of these administrators.
It talks about other stories that you've written. I mean, it's a big nothing burger, but buried in the middle, Dan, about halfway through the article.
Yeah.
It says, in a presentation on student assessment made at the May 26th school board meeting, Administrator Lori Fiorenza said the school plans to establish, quote, an equitable grading philosophy by next year. The only mention of race came in a slide that was skipped over at the meeting, but said the school would evaluate grading using evidence-based research and the racial equity analysis tool. So that is what they are doing next year. Don't let them fool you. But the Tribune reporter buried that in the middle of the article.
It's just a euphemistic way to say the same thing. I mean, and we went through a lot of just documents from Oak Park River Forest High School yesterday. The master plan, does this help or hurt racial equity? Everything is forced through the racial equity prism at Oak Park River Forest High School. It's all they talk about. There are 9 pages in the parent-student handbook that I referenced. I gave you page citations, 47 to 58, yesterday. It's all race all the time, all identitarianism all the time, and all specifically race all the time.
Let me give you, or lights in the gym.
Fire sprinkler suppression system, does it advance racial equity, yes or no? The fixing the tennis courts, well, it doesn't because more white kids play tennis than black kids. And so everything. This is what they do. This is what they've always done. This is who they are. And now they're pretending, what are you talking about? Yeah, okay. Here's what I'm talking about. I'll give you another example. Okay. In their own words, this is from please keep piling on. Or what you think is piling on. Keep trying to chase this down and gaslight everybody to believe this is misinformation. The students are going to tell you. The parents are going to tell you. But go ahead. And by the way, this is just an example because it's an example of so many things. What's happening at Oak Park River Forest is happening in various degrees throughout most school districts, whether you realize it or not. It's just that Oak Park River Forest has been so out and proud about it until we amplified what they're out and proud about, or we stripped away some of the euphemisms and essentially told you what it really is. Maybe people were being buffaloed by the euphemism. I don't know. Dr. Patrick Hardy, he's the OPRF Executive Director of Equity and Student Success. This is Dr. Patrick Hardy at the January 27th, 2022 District 200 meeting.
Okay.
The administration, the leadership knows, they've heard this speech from me a million times in different ways and in different spaces. Equity is everywhere. This notion of what are the equity items that we're doing, everything is about equity. And so and people are maybe getting a little uncomfortable saying, I need to call Patrick. And Patrick is saying, nope, you have to call Dr. Fiorenza about teaching and learning and where equity is happening there. And Dr. Fiorenza has been doing a phenomenal job. racializing our work, the racialization of assessment, and how do we build equitable assessments?
Equity is everything. Oh, it's God. Everywhere. Fiorenza has been doing excellent work racializing our assessment, racializing the evaluation. What do you think that means? What does that implicate? You can. I don't care how many times the Tribune wants to call this fake news or anybody else. Either English words and actual actions mean something or they don't. Don't believe your lying eyes and ears. In the Tribune story, this is it's just delightful. Ralph Martiri, who I've debated before, who I love the, you know, I'm like a crypto conservative, right wing, blah, 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 chipped out of ICE. Ralph Martiri, as a member of the school board, yeah. A left leaning nonprofit called the Center for Tax and Budget. It's just slightly left of center. This is a guy who believes that every dollar the government spends has a positive return, among other things. I mean, this guy is so far left. Okay. It's laughable. But maybe the center is just so far left that I don't know. I just love, yeah. Crypto fascist, left-leaning nonprofit director.
Of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability.
Speaking of euphemisms.
I know, please.
Orwellian in style. Here's his response.
Yes. Quote.
Martyr gave a benign, this is the reporting on it before you get to his quote, gave a benign explanation of the contemplated changes, using an example of a student who scores a zero on a quiz but later shows command of the material. Why should those 0 points hold down that kid's grade when the kid is demonstrating mastery of the academic content? That's what moving to an equitable grading system is. It's understanding that students grow at different paces. That is not benign. That is also, I don't know, maybe I have been chipped out of ICE, even though I was in school not that long ago, for goodness sake.
Well,
that is anti-academic.
Right.
What do you mean, benign? First of all, the reporter, benign explanation. Why should 0 points hold down that kid's grade when the kid is demonstrating mastery of the academic content? That's what moving to an equitable grading system is. It's something that students grow at different paces. So the kid who aces the quiz and aces the final should get the same grade as the kid who zeros the quiz and aces the final. See, when I was in school, maybe it has been too long. I don't know. When I was in school, Amy, maybe Hersey was different. I don't know. So if I – not that this ever happened, of course. But if I got a bad grade on a quiz or a homework assignment, I knew I had to make it up on the final or the midterm or the
It motivated you to work harder.
Yeah.
Well, it motivated you to be a better student and change your learning habits.
Well, also, though, too, you knew what the score was.
Right.
Said, I soiled the bed here on the midterm, so now I got to do well on the final to get a B or B plus or whatever, or C or whatever it is.
And why, now you don't have to if you're a minority.
Why should a zero? Because you got a zero. Why should a zero count against you? Because you did badly. Why?
What did they say yesterday? Because you didn't fail. You didn't meet up to the objectives of the class or something.
Yeah, well, no, that's like my that was, like. It's oh, like yeah. No, nobody failed. You just didn't. You succeeded at not meeting standards.
That's what it was.
Yeah, it's just all success. Why should my triple on 8, ruin my golf score? Because I showed on the back 9 that I can play golf. So that triple I got on 8, that shouldn't count against my golf score.
But yes, it does, sir, because they haven't changed the way you score golf yet. But that's coming.
But understand, this is not something we uncovered.
No, this is going on.
No. But this is the defense they're offering to what's going on.
Yeah, they're doubling down.
How do you react to the quality of this defense? You get a zero, but at some point in time in the undetermined future, you demonstrate mastery of the material. Well, then you're going to get better grades when you're tested on your mastery of the material. Otherwise, Ralph, how would you know the student has mastered the material if he or she is not tested? So why should their failure to master it or begin mastering it at an early stage when you're having quizzes or homework assignments that usually count as less a percentage of the total grade than the final or the final paper. Why should that count against? To show progress. To measure. Am I out of my... Somebody's out of their mind on this. So it's either me or him.
I'm going to go with him.
Okay. Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I want to know, I heard you talking about this the other day, and I didn't have time to call in. I want to know, where are all the black parents calling in saying, wait a minute, the adoption of these ridiculous new standards are just saying, my children are stupid, and you've got to do this because they're stupid. You're actually telling me I'm incapable of competing on a level playing field with the rest of humanity. Where's the outrage? I'm either thinking, I don't know, are the parents so disengaged they don't realize that this is a concerted effort to say you and your entire people are stupid?
Well,
why aren't they screaming that?
Well, it's a good point, Ralph, and thanks for the call. And I mean, this is what we talk about with the likes of Thomas Sowell or Glenn Lowry or Ian Rowe, Jason Riley, you know, all these accomplished black intellects, journalists, authors, school administrators. We've had a great conversation the other day with Michigan State political philosophy professor on this very topic. He just edited a book of essays from all these actual thinkers that should be in charge of more schools and universities. This starts, he's exactly right. This, no counting off for missed assignments. No, you're not turning your homework, missing days, misbehavior. Could it be any more patronizing? Hey, black parents, black families, we know your kids are shiftless, lazy, and unable to control themselves, so we're not going to count that against them.
And they should be, you know, held to different standards than their white friends. It's embarrassing. It's shameful. That's what I said. Remember when you first told me about this story? I said, where are the black parents fighting back? Why aren't they protesting this?
Something else that's going on here, too, and this is in part why I think there's been such a vociferous response from the institutional left here in the region. Friends of mine at OPRF saying that some of the honkies in the senior class at OPRF did not get their preferred college.
Right.
And so now word about how they're being graded. Now it's like, wait a second, did you skew the system against, you know, honky families? The honky leftists are saying, did you skew this against my honky son or daughter and prevent him or her from getting into their preferred college? For example, one kid, 35 ACT.
Holy, 35 ACT?
Yes, almost perfect. 4.2 out of 4 scale got waitlisted University of Michigan.
Well?
Yeah, well.
It's a thing.
And
What was his,
Yeah, yeah.
What do you call it? Essay about.
Well, I don't have, I didn't review his application. I'm just saying, based on the stats,
The stats, that's.
And also what they thought, the expectations. Mm-hmm.
Waitlisted at U of M.
Yeah. Lots of sensitivity right now. And I guess the argument goes many of the black kids did get their preferred college. And so now you have the honky leftists in Oak Park River Forest saying, wait a second. What's going on here? Are you wiring this for them and against me? And that's a great way to create racial comedy, isn't it? Harmony.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens when you count by race.
Well, I had a parent come up to me because, my son's Hispanic and I don't say Latinx because I will never say that, and said, well, your son's the only person I know that got into Tulane. Nobody I know got into Tulane, not just from Amundsen, but from different selective enrollment schools.
Or attempted to.
Pardon?
Or attempted to get into Tulane.
No, he got accepted to Tulane.
No, I know.
Right.
Nobody else did because nobody else tried to.
No, they tried.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people try to get into Tulane that did not get or got waitlisted or just flat out rejected.
I'm just saying,
but it's.
Do you start?
But I don't see even, he's number one in his class. He did really well in the ACT and the SAT.
Do you understand what Frederick Douglass was talking about? It's 175 years ago now. Do you understand what he's talking about? I don't want any government that confers benefits or imposes responsibilities by race. Do you get the insight that a freed slave had on these pernicious race-based systems, whether it's Jim Crow or it's grading by race in Oak Park River Forest? Maurice and Berwyn.
You know, Dan, everything doesn't deserve a response. Even for me as an African-American, who I say all the time, education saved my life. I'm more than happy to be called myself a conservative Democrat. I will crawl on broken glass before I call myself a progressive.
Okay.
Education standards need to stay the same for everyone. These kids need to learn traditional education. But I also would say this. Maybe more conservatives need to get the education.
Totally.
And not leave it to so many Republicans. I mean, so many liberals.
Yeah.
Get in the game, guys.
Yeah.
Education saved my life.
Thank you, Maurice.
So, your points are well taken.
Thank you, Maurice. Appreciate the call. Tony, Downers Grove.
And just make the final 100% of the grade.
Then it won't count if I do bad on it, if I'm of a particular characteristic profile.
Well, right, but you make it 100% for everybody, then we'll see what kind of excuse comes up.
Yeah, we'll get to take it again. I mean, this is what that Lyons Township English teacher resigned about. It's like, you know, you do drafts and revisions, and then you get a grade, and then you got 2 weeks to do more revisions to try and improve your grade. I mean, it just never ends.
Well, so that's the point, though. It's not the equity. It's the fact that the line keeps on moving, just like everything else.
Well, the line, exactly. Thanks for the call, Tony. But of course, the line has to move because they have a conclusion, and they're trying to work back and provide a legitimacy to the conclusion they have already decided will be the conclusion. They've already determined who's going to get what. Now we got to work back and come up with a cover story for the decision we've already made. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. A couple things. One, Amy, your kids aren't Hispanic. They're half Hispanic.
Puerto Ricans, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But trying to mark that box, huh? Because you can't find it.
Yeah.
So unique.
But, you know, I went to Lane for high school, and I say this with no pride whatsoever, but I was failing college algebra as a senior. And, you know, of course, believe it or not, my dad had to go in and talk to the teacher. He came out and told me, he says, that woman absolutely hates your guts. He goes, she doesn't hate you personally. She hates the fact that you're not doing the work to get the job done. This kid could get the best grade in the class. And, you know, get straight A's and all that. He just doesn't do the work. And to be honest, I got the second highest grade on the final. Got a C in the class. That's all I deserved.
There you go.
Got to take into account what people do or don't do throughout the year in school. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Hey, yeah, and a teacher saying coming down hard on you because she knows what you can do and what you're not doing. That's a good teacher.
Yeah.
If you're talking about it. Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and Matt Walsh. I can't wait to check out his documentary, What is a Woman? I haven't watched it yet, but there are some snippets of it online. We played the trailer the other week.
I got to see this.
Looks
movie.
Like some, he got some good interviews. The snippet released, and Matt Walsh is a podcaster. I think he's over at the Daily Wire and so on and so forth. And he's written a lot about these gender identitarian issues as well. This clip that he posted is really fantastic. He interviews the chieftains of an African tribe.
Okay.
Just ask them, you know, simple questions about gender and gender identity. And here's how that went.
What if a man decides that his gender identity is woman?
A woman has its own duty and a man has its own duty, and a lady cannot duty the duty of a man, and a man cannot do a duty of a woman.
Can a man become a woman?
No.
No?
No.
What about a transgender? Huh? Transgender?
No.
No.
It will look like to, if you want to become a lady but you're a man, you have something wrong in
something
your
wrong.
Mind. Something wrong in your family, something wrong in you.
What about if someone was non-binary?
Come again?
Non-binary?
Come again. Uh-huh.
Do you know, like non... Like someone is
you're not a woman, you're not a man.
Yeah, someone's like, someone is neither. They're something else. Is that...
He's saying we have never seen things like those. For a man, he has a penis. For a woman, he has a vagina. So we know this is a lady, this is a man.
What if it's a woman with a... What if it's a woman with a penis?
Both?
Is that...
And tabo.
People are laughing. Is that a dumb question?
I'll tell you, that African tribe should think about opening a dye consultancy,
and they can
go around and get Fortune 500 businesses, maybe provide some balance to the consultants that are shaking them down at present. For more on... all topics, law enforcement and culture related. Pleased to be joined by David Marcus, columnist living in New York City, author of Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. That clip is amazing. I applaud Matt for his missionary
yes.
work, bringing the woke gospel to all parts of the world. Just amazing. The whole thing's fantastic.
Well, I know. I'm thinking about trying to identify where that village is and relocating there, because at least
right.
I would have, I could regain my sanity.
Yeah, that's right.
But here we are. I mean, and you wrote about Netflix and the neo-Jacobin mobs. Here we are, as Rod Dreher calls it, in the high holy month of pride. And, you can't shake a stick without getting into an argument about whether or not the pride flag has all the requisite colors on it.
Yeah. And I mean, you're risking a seizure at this point just by looking at
right.
some of them. But, look, the good news is that over the past couple of weeks, we've seen some really significant moves by companies like Netflix and HBO to back off of this crazy wokeness. For example, Netflix just last week announced that it was cutting a whole bunch of its sort of diversity programming. Ibram Kendi's anti-racist baby
right.
Television show isn't going to be made. So I'm sorry if you were looking forward to that. They cut that. HBO is bringing J.K. Rowling back. Just last year, she wasn't allowed to appear at the 20th anniversary special of the Harry Potter movies, which she invented because of her alleged transphobia. She's back. State Farm's made some moves. So I think these companies are realizing this is no longer the path of least resistance here.
Well, I had a good friend that, he's been using State Farm for years and called after listening to this show and said, I'm done with you. And he said, wait, please don't leave. I've enjoyed your business and we're going to change the policy. And sure enough, they did change it. But did they really change it? I mean, is anybody checking to see whether or not State Farm employees on the weekends are handing out LGBTQIA+ books to children?
Yeah, I don't know if they're checking, but I do know that they're worried. I think that they saw what happened in Florida when DeSantis really just smacked Disney in the mouth. And they realized that unlike 4 or 5 years ago when conservative or even middle-of-the-road Americans would just sort of roll their eyes at this stuff, now there's a price to pay. They've seen Disney pay that price, and they don't want to pay that price themselves.
Well, the other thing, too, that's happened is you can look away when it's a one-day parade that resembles something out of Caligula in a downtown area. It makes it more difficult to work away, to look away, I should say, when it becomes part of your grade school kids' curriculum.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that was another huge part of this was, you know, activists and journalists like, you know, Chris Rufo or Libs of TikTok were, you know, showing us just how crazy, you know, a lot of this stuff was. And whether it's on the fringes or not, the fact that it's in public schools at all, I think was, you know, clearly alarmed American parents. And I think the third leg of this stool is that corporations for a couple decades now have just assumed that the Republican Party will offer them nothing to fear because it's limited government, stay out of businesses, will say that they were never worried about anything that Republicans might do. Obviously, what DeSantis did with Disney has changed that. You got guys like Josh Hawley in the Senate who, you know, really want to get involved in social media in terms of making those fairer platforms. So the GOP has also changed here, and I think corporations are reacting to that.
I wanted to get your reaction to the big guy's national address last evening on guns in the wake of these horrific atrocities in Buffalo and Uvalde and in Tulsa as well. I mean, I don't know that there's anything new to say about it because I don't know that there was anything new said.
No, I don't think there is. I think the president had two options last night. He could have gone very small, sort of like been in touch with the group of bipartisan senators who were trying to get, you know, the low hanging fruit done and really focused in on that. Instead, he decided to give a very classic anti-Second Amendment, you know, anti-NRA political speech, you know, probably gearing up to try to make this an issue in the midterms. But it clearly wasn't designed to actually engender any immediate action.
Right. I mean, Karine Jean-Pierre says it's not going to be partisan, and then he blames Republicans for allowing the assault weapon ban to sunset back in 2005. He also does this two-step that we've seen before, but it probably bears some focus and discussion so nobody gets fooled, particularly some weak-kneed Republican members of Congress. You know, he respects law-abiding gun owners, and he respects, you know, a culture that provides for the right of self-defense. Well, no, he doesn't, because he doesn't believe that it's an individual right, and he refers to those individual members who form groups like the NRA or the Gun Owners of America as the nefarious boogeyman, the gun lobby. So that's just disingenuity, which is, I mean, what we're used to, but it still bears calling out, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he also appeared to be suggesting that Americans shouldn't be able to own 9mm handguns at one point.
Right.
You know, and then the White House jumps back on the walkback treadmill, which is like a perpetual motion machine at this point. Like, oh, no, that's not what he meant. I mean, listen, I would love to be able to agree with you that Biden is betraying some kind of hypocrisy here. I'm not convinced Biden has any idea what his position on this is. And I'm really not convinced that it matters, because it's pretty obvious that Biden isn't making any of these decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I mean, of course, over the course of the last half century, he's been all over the place, because perhaps what he really is and has always been, as some have argued, including me, frankly, is he's a company man. I mean, he's not particularly bright, and he's not particularly thoughtful. So he doesn't work at it. So he just goes wherever the zeitgeist of the party is. And the zeitgeist of the party right now is with the socialists.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he's always been a soldier. I mean, you can argue that maybe he was a capo when he was vice president. But as the Don, this is really not working out.
What about at the local level where the action really is here? And as we wrestle, by the way, you know, according to one way that you measure mass shootings, Chicago has the most mass shootings of any city in the country since 2018. So we know it. You've seen the violent crime spike in New York City. Are you seeing anything in New York from Eric Adams that is encouraging you at all with respect to these anomalous mass shooting events or the more general topic of violent crime?
I mean, not nearly enough is really the answer. And it's frustrating because, you know, this is true in Chicago as well, but I think especially in New York, where a lot of, you know, in the early and mid 90s, a lot of the police tactics, like broken windows, like CompStat, like stop, question, and frisk, were used and were effective. We know how to do this. You know, this isn't alchemy. There's no need to reinvent the wheel. And Adams has done little things here and there, but just not enough. And it's deeply, deeply frustrating, as I'm sure it is in Chicago, because it feels like the city is a coiled spring that's ready to come back. And our political leadership, just at every turn, seems to keep us boxed in.
He is David Marcus, columnist living in New York City, author of Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. David, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, the May jobs number is out. 360,000 jobs. Unemployment rate's a little above street estimates. Unemployment rate, which means nothing, stays at about 3.6%. Not about
That's a
at 3.6.
Absolute joke.
But I don't want to listen to KJP try to explain inflation. I don't want to listen to Captain Kangaroo try to explain inflation. I certainly don't want to listen to the big guy explain it or explain anything related to economics. But I am interested when Jamie Dimon says that, and this has been a little bit misreported for the purpose of whipping frenzy.
Yeah, whip my frenzy.
There's a hurricane in the offing that's about to strike the U.S. economy. But what he really said is people are expecting that Jay Powell and the Fed can navigate the unwinding of the pandemic era funny money spend. And so we don't know if it's going to be a downpour or a hurricane.
And now we're learning this morning through a leaked internal email that Elon Musk blames super bad feeling about the economy, and he plans to cut 10% of Tesla jobs.
For more on this, pleased to be joined by our friend James Perry, Senior Vice President and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you for having me.
Well, so you can comment on the jobs number if you want, and if you don't want to, that's fine, too, because I don't know how impactful it really is in the broader understanding of what's happening. What about Jamie Dimon's comments? I'm more interested in getting your reaction to.
Well, it's funny, you know, he tends to be pretty optimistic because he's talking his book. And for him to come out and switch gears like that and talk about a hurricane should not be taken lightly.
Is he right, though, that the expectation is that the Fed is going to stick the landing with respect to the unwinding and the rate hiking? And if for some reason they don't, then we're going to optimism quickly turned to cynicism and the negative impacts resulting from that.
Right. Well, there's a lot of moving parts to that. Let's just start with the idea that we've got stagflation, right? So slowing growth and rising prices. And the Fed really can't do that much about rising prices, right? Oil, food, and labor. That's a function of economic demand, supply and demand. So all they can do is raise interest rates to do one thing, two things, really. They're going to crush the value of risk assets, and they're going to crush the propensity for the consumer to spend.
And so if that's what they're doing, well, this before we even get to that, you said stagflation. You're using the wrong terminology. We have a newspeak that describes the situation. Brian Deese, the chief economic advisor to Biden, said this week, we're moving to a period of stable growth, which is to say slow growth, which is to say stagflation. But they're calling it stable growth. That's the my interpretation. That's their euphemism for slow diminished growth, right?
Right. I mean, everybody with half a brain realizes that that's complete nonsense. I mean, let's just kind of recognize that the administration has to spin something because they don't know what to do. The bottom line here, Dan, is simply that, you know, really, the Fed's trillions of dollars of money printing over the last 10 years, really since the great financial crisis of 2009, 2008, 2009, and 2010. You know, they printed $10 trillion, right? And given half of it directly to consumers. So, and now Powell says it's over. So the only reason risk assets are here and consumer spending has been here for the last few years, really just since the pandemic, is because everybody's had free money to spend. And now it's over. And savings rates are falling, and propensity to spend, propensity to emerge and spend, as measured by these sort of, you know, search activity algorithms at Google, every single category, of which there are 20, is negative, right? This is everything from food delivery and self-employment, computers, travel, apartments, car rentals, hotels, restaurants, vacations, autos. Every single category, as measured by consumers, is negative. So GDP was negative 1.5% in the first quarter. I don't know how people measure recessions, but usually it's 3 months of negative growth. That's a recession. So you're in a recession already. And Q2 is probably going to get worse. So the economy is shrinking.
And then you have, like, President Biden 2 days ago said, sorry, there's nothing I can do right now to help with gas prices and with food prices.
Yeah, I mean, look in the mirror. I mean, honestly, most of this is regulatory. Yes, the war in Ukraine, it's in its 100th day, right? The Russians aren't going anywhere. That's going to hurt Europe for another 100 days. Europe's in a recession already. Asia's in a recession. The China supply chain is continuing to wreak havoc on deliveries of goods and services. And, you know, the administration doesn't look at itself and say, gee, the regulations that we've put in since we've been in office are the vast majority of the reasons for why we're here. So if the government can't be honest with itself, consumers are going to, or taxpayers are going to continue to lose faith in the administration's ability to solve problems because they don't really know what to do.
You know,
they don't think economically.
Right. And all this, it's so funny too. You have all these radical capitalists exist in Wall Street, at least some of them. I mean, I know there's a lot of rent seekers too, but the idea that you're expecting the Fed to stick the landing or government policy, government, the people who brought us to this place to get us out of this place to which they've brought us. The whole thing right now, oh, the economy is overheating. That's, you know, we need stable growth because it's overheating. The idea that we're supposed to grow at the pace of central planners and then we're supposed to shrink at the pace of central planners and that market makers stipulate to that, it just has always struck me as incredible folly. And I don't know why the people are not more aggressive about trying to clear away the central planners and the central planning because they're making terrible medium-term trade-offs. So 10 years of funny money where you can pump the market and then, you know, God only knows what happens for the next decade.
Right. I mean, the government, nobody in Washington, and even the guys that are supposedly economists, seem to have ever balanced their checkbook or let alone have a budget for their house. Money to the government is something they can use to enhance the narrative that they're pushing in social justice or something. And that's a nice kumbaya kind of feeling, but, you know, the real world looks at, you know, rent payments and mortgage payments and car payments. You know, look no further than small businesses, which really, I mean, you know this, everybody knows it. It's 80% of the jobs in this country are small businesses. And 8 out of 10 small business owners expect a deeper recession in 2022. That's 80% of the people who work on a day-to-day basis. And they feel it. So the narrative coming out of Washington, We hear it. We have to watch it. We look at all this news. But the real spender, the real taxpayer, doesn't have to turn on the TV and listen to the White House press briefings to understand that they're in trouble and their disposable income at the household level is negative.
And you mentioned something. You mentioned that savings rates are declining. You also had a graphic that you sent out to your subscribers this week that showed for the first time in 3 years, you know, pre-pandemic, you have credit card debt exceeding savings rate.
Right. I mean, this is real stuff. The savings rate has plunged. The money supply going through the economy has plunged. The velocity of money through the economy has plunged. And credit card debt is at the highest it's been since before 2010, right? It's and I don't know if you keep a debit balance on your credit cards, but, you know, the debit payments on credit cards is 24%, right?
Yeah.
They were 15 before the pandemic. They're 24%. And the minimum payment, you've got a $1,000 credit card deficit or debit, and, you know, you're required to pay $100 a month or $80 a month. That other $900, they're charging you 24% to carry that debit balance. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. So as you're, you know, with sort of the landscape as you're describing it, people that got out and went to cash or went more significantly to cash and are trying to pick their spot to get back in, which I always know is a dangerous business. I'm talking about the equities market. We're a long way from the bottom in your estimation at present.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, if you just look at the S&P 500, the pre-pandemic high was 3,400. And the high in January on the 4th was 4,800. But, you know, back when this whole thing started, when QE started, the S&P was at 1,000. And the fact is that, you know, a lot of people don't recognize that even from the pre-pandemic low, under the pandemic lows to the highs in January, the stock market was up 120%. And now we're down, what, 22 or 20%? So, let's just get back to the pre-pandemic highs, which is about 3,400. That's the target in the short term. And if the Fed's going to go 50 basis points on June 15th and 50 basis points on July 27th, and then they're going to start unwinding this balance sheet, you know, why aren't you supposed to get back down to the pre-pandemic lows, you know?
Well, and as
I think
And to your point, too, but pre-pandemic, we were talking about how do we unwind from 7 years of quantitative easing? Now we're talking about how do we unwind from 10 years of quantitative easing plus the pandemic kicker?
Exactly. And in 2019, maybe a lot of people kind of forget this, but, you know, that's when we did QE4 or QE infinity, as they call it, because in the fourth quarter of 2019, before the pandemic, we were going into a recession then, right? So now we're going into recession and the stock market's, 1,500 points higher. It just seems like it's overvalued from just a historic basis. And then if you look at sort of the price earnings multiple, you know, forward earnings in the S&P are something like 16 now the next year. But normally at the bottom of bear markets, they go down to 11, you know, and as low as 8. So The earnings issue for corporations is the problem when consumers are going to stop spending. Two-thirds of the economy, two-thirds of GDP is consumer spending, and if it's going to come down 30%, GDP is going to be minus 3.
Before we let you go, just a quick stop, look, and listen on crypto, because it's cooled a little bit, but it's still much talked about. Bitcoin continues to hover right around or just under 30,000. What's your take on how crypto is performing in this precarious environment?
Well, we've talked about this regularly since we've been speaking together. And I sent you something yesterday, which I think is interesting. There was a report out yesterday that says 94% of crypto owners are between the ages of 18 and 40, right? And they don't know what the value is. All they know is the meta universe is coming and crypto is going to be at $500,000 when it gets here. Well, guys like Warren Buffett don't like that because he says, well, I'd rather buy an asset that's got some return on it, like a piece of real estate, a farm, or a building that I can pay rent. So, you know, intrinsically, he's 100% right. The trouble is, you know, Bitcoin really was invented as a practical solution to a longstanding problem of how to establish trust between unrelated parties on an unreliable network like the internet. And, you know, is that coming? I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of regulatory stuff that happens. And, you know, this whole Luna thing that went down, you know, this is fraud. So it's going to have bumps, and this is a big one. I think blockchain is going to be here. It's ubiquitous. But like I said to you many times in the past, you know, what's the value of Bitcoin? Is it $1,000? Is it $100,000? Nobody really knows. All I know is it's going up because more people are using it. And at some point, there's going to be some regulation on it that's going to make something happen digitally. Digital money is coming, but it's not here yet.
James Perry, Senior VP and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks as always.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, Dan, I checked this stuff out so you don't have to. But yesterday, Mayor Lightfoot responded to Paul Ballas, and now Roderick Sawyer, jumping into the race, you know, for mayor.
Yeah.
So, you know, another day, another man who thinks he can do his job better than me.
You know, and she also said,
and I've got the bigger schlong.
Yeah.
We're going to have a schlong contest. Did I say
that? We should have asked Paul Ballas if he thinks he's packing more heat than Triple Threat.
I don't want to know. And then they, WTTW, my favorite, what's her name? Heather Sharon, who I called Sarah once, and she was all, you don't know who I am.
Morning. About a year ago, you told WTTW that you believed about 99% of the criticism you got as Chicago mayor was because you're a black woman. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like anything has changed over the last year?
No. No. I see some of the women in the audience. Mm-hmm. Women are always going to be judged by a different lens. And people of color are always judged by a different lens. That's just the reality of our lives. I think people who are part of the LGBTQ plus community in leadership are judged through a different lens. That's just the reality of life in America. I'm a big believer in playing the cards that were dealt, and I'm going to keep doing what I think is right on behalf of residents of the city.
That is a perfect 10 on the identitarian scoring system.
Score winner, the gold medal goes to Mayor Lori Lightfoot.
That's why she's the triple threat. You just heard it right there. She got there by being the triple threat. Why would you think that she would offer anything other than her triple threat prowess?
Another day.
Just another day.
Just another day. Another
day and another guy who thinks he can measure up. Well, get out the yardstick, Roderick and Paul, and get a load of this. Thump.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Yes, it's that time of the week, Dan and Amy and our Open Mic Friday, taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. Comments, compliments, criticisms, general correct pottery, we'll take it all. We start with some comments about last evening's Illinois GOP gubernatorial debate.
Yes, I found it quite humorous and enlightening when Gary Rabine made his closing argument, you know, they each got 1 minute to discuss, you know, why people should vote for them.
So if we want a farmer to lead our state, Darren's the only guy. If it's a beauty contest and a good-looking man, boy, you know what? We have no chance. Jesse wins by a landslide. If we want a Democrat to lead the Republican Party, Richard, you're the guy. 7 of 8 of the last elections, you voted in a Democratic primary. I've never voted in a Democratic primary, and 3 of the 4 top candidates have. I got to tell you, it's time to elect a leader who's built and turned around businesses and understands what it's like to turn things around. because, boy, we need it in Illinois. It's time to elect a governor also that can lead Illinois, my moonshot, to be the state by 2025 where more people are moving into our state than any other state in America.
So, yeah.
That was pretty good.
That was good.
It was a moment of levity.
Although, here's the thing about that. If you want a farmer to lead the state of Illinois, yeah, Darren Bailey's a farmer. You know what a farmer is?
Somebody who produces.
He's a business
and
person.
And he's a business person, right. Yeah. And he's also a state rep and a state senator, so he knows Springfield.
Like a farmer, like he's some sort of unsophisticated hayseed. I think that's what some people think, or at least that's the insinuation some people make.
He
and his wife started a Christian school in addition to running a family farm, in addition to him being a school board member and then a legislator. So, you know, Gary Rabine is a man of great accomplishment in business, but
I think he's just trying to be funny.
No, I get what he's doing, but the whole farmer thing, like he's some hick who doesn't know about our sophisticated ways up here in Chicagoland. That's just untrue. Speaking of Darren Bailey, I thought he had a fun close as well, and it was set up, and it was off the cuff, you know, because it was set up nicely by the fact that Richard Irvin closed before Darren did. So here's the part of Irvin's close that he used to attack Bailey. This is an argument he's making, by the way, in commercials, which we'll address momentarily.
But the reality is, you got to wonder, why is J.B. Pritzker spending tens of millions of dollars to attack me and to help my opponent, Darren Bailey? Because he knows Darren Bailey can't win a general election against him, and he knows that I'll beat him. That's why he's spending, in the Republican primary, he's spending tens of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. And Bailey's response, setting up his clothes?
Well, I'm a farmer, and I'm glad I wore my boots tonight because it's really starting to get deep in here. So, and we're starting to have fun. We're just getting warmed up. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
I like Darren Bailey. He's a happy – I mean, I'm backing him, as anybody listening to the show knows. So, but I'm a happy warrior. I like that. Also, to the argument that Irvin's making, and he's making commercials about the DGA is running ads against Richard Irvin, the DGA Pritzker running ads in support of Bailey. Be careful what you wish for. What kind of argument is that? A political handicapping argument? Be careful what you wish for. I remember in 2016 when the Democrats, socialists all wanted Trump to be the nominee because then it was going to be a walk in the park. I remember in 2018 when the same combine Republicans said that can't hold Bruce Rauner responsible for what he actually did as governor. You have to not renominate him to face whoever comes out of that primary at the time, because it wasn't a fait accompli that Pritzker would be the nominee. Can't elect Jeannie Ives because she can't win a general. Bruce Rauner went on to score the lowest amount of votes for a Republican nominee for governor, much less an incumbent in Illinois history. That political handicappers, they know everything. The politicians, they know everything. They know exactly. They've got their finger on the pulse of the electorate. They know exactly how things are going to turn out. That's the way you want to play it? That's the argument you have? I thought the argument when it came to the standard bearer for your party was, yes, viability. That's part of the equation. But how about reliability? How about reliability that the nominee for your party, the titular leader of your party, is going to represent your values and you trust and believe he will go to the mat for policies consistent with those principles? Boy, you know, we haven't tried that very often in the Republican primary, particularly for governor, over the last couple of decades. Maybe we give that a shot. It may be just crazy enough to work. Bob and Lyle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. Yeah, I want to say that, all this gun legislation that's probably going to come down the pike, they're going to take away everybody's gun because people don't realize that any gun will kill you. And the fact of the matter is, and I'll tell you this from a tactical point of view, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I know how to shoot every kind of machine gun they had because that's what I did. And I'm an ex-point man. I'm an ex-deputy sheriff. The fact of the matter is, if you have a semi-automatic or a revolver in close quarters, that's a better tactical weapon than any rifle, unless it's an automatic. And these are all semi-automatics. So if you're in a school situation, you have better maneuverability with a handgun, and plus your accuracy is going to be a lot greater. So this whole idea of coming against the rifle is a foolish one, because they have guns now that are so powerful, even with a 10-clip magazine, and so accurate that you could take out anybody. So, this whole gun thing is just a coolest thing.
Well, of course, thanks for the call, Bob. Of course it is, because it's not based on enhancing safety. It's not based on tactical or physical realities. It's just based on emotion. Go do something. That's what the big guy said yesterday. Go do something. Do something. That's what everybody's saying. Do something. Make me feel better about. Make me feel better. Don't make me safer. I don't care. I mean, I guess ostensibly I don't care if I'm actually going to be safer or not. I just want to feel better, like we did something in response. That's how a lot of people think, or more to the point, don't think. Jerry Alsop.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I just wanted to call and comment on the debate last night. I think of all the people who performed best performance, or the person who gained the most ground out of this debate would be Max Solomon. Not a lot of people are familiar with him, and he showed himself to be a strong conservative. I think Darren Bailey had a pretty poor performance like he did in the first debate, and a lot of his problem is he has a lot of self-inflicted wounds. He'll have these moments where he seems a little arrogant and braggadocious, and he sticks his foot in his own mouth.
Well, when did he do that? I didn't interpret that at all.
I didn't see that last night. I thought his performance was much better than the first debate.
He said the thing about the hellhole, and then he was better. Okay. I'll give you that.
First of all, that's not okay, sticking his foot in his mouth, because it is a hellhole. And he explained it last night, and I thought he provided nice context to it. Oh, Chicago's not? In the way
why did he look like he pooped his pants like a two-year-old when the lady asked him about, did you just call Chicago a hellhole? And then he backpedaled, and he looked a little scared. He didn't look confident in his response.
Well, he was confident.
What was the performance last night? What was the particulars?
When he allowed Richard Irvin to hit him on how he forced migrant workers on his farm to wear masks.
Yeah. Okay, Jerry. Thanks for the call. Max Solomon. I like Max Solomon. I think he's a pretty sharp guy from
he's
the debate performances. And yeah, I think he is a solid conservative. The Darren Bailey thing, those formats are difficult. There were moments Bailey turned and confronted Irvin. Rabine pressed Irvin. Sullivan pressed Irvin. Schimpf pressed Bailey. There were moments for a lot of the candidates. But it's difficult, and then you've got a moderator, you know, so not allowing you to interrupt, so not allowing how those interactions. So you got to answer a question and then also respond to everything that's asserted about you in 45 seconds. Difficult to do that with respect to every attack when you're the main target or targets of the attacks, as Irvin and Bailey are. As terms of the masks for migrant workers, I mean, here again, we have somebody projecting onto another who they are, like the left does. So Richard Irvin was in charge of the COVID response for the city of Aurora, and he imposed the mask mandates.
Enforced them, yes. The penalty would be a fine.
Threatened businesses with respect to enforcement, unlike, say, Keith Pikow did in Orland Park or other mayors did. Ultimately, Craig, a little late to the dance. Relax. Morley in Elmhurst early. Saviano in Elmwood Park didn't enforce. Not going to do it. Different. Irvin also imposed a vaccine mandate on employees. He's in charge. Imposed a vaccine mandate on city employees. If you want to make that your metric. On a farm, migrant workers through a federal program, he was required to comply with the federal guidelines for that migrant worker program, which included masking. A little bit different.
Well, it's on a federal level, right?
A little bit different. Who's in charge and who's making the decisions versus who's complying with accessing a program and the strictures for accessing that program in that particular sector. And this is where I guess you have to do a little bit better than Jerry and Alsip and get beyond just watching an hour debate where each of six candidates has about 15 minutes and 45 or 15 second blocks to answer questions. And you actually have to think through things. And you actually have to do a little bit of reading and research and listening so that you can separate the wheat from the chaff to continue our farming lexicon here.
I think the person who lost out the most was Jesse Sullivan because ABC mailed each candidate a PCR, a specific PCR test they had to take and mail in 2 days before. And he's perfectly healthy. He's fine. And I just think nobody else did that. NBC didn't do it. WGN, those weren't parameters of attending the debate. And we here at AM 560 for our June 23rd debate will not be testing.
Yeah, it was testing
healthy people. Get over it. Relax.
It was ridiculous.
Stupid.
However, I thought Sullivan turned in a solid performance, even though he had the max headroom. You know,
yeah, but if he was there, I think it would have been different.
Mitchell displays.
Yeah. Good morning. First of all, with regards to gun control, one element they're leaving out are these kids, these centennials and millennials that are addicted to video games. Okay. No one wants to go and take on the fact that when you combine that with SSRIs, those are the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Okay. You have a problem because these social outcasts have become amoral. Okay, they have actually no regard for life, not one scintilla, okay, of actually understanding the consequences of their actions. The teachers gave up their power. They're addicted to video games and vaping in the high school level and the junior high school level. So when they come out as a social outcast or a misfit, and when they snap, you got a gigantic problem.
All right, okay? Thanks for the call, Mitchell. You know, the video games thing, again, when you want to zero in on a single causal factor that you're alleging, you have to explain why even being a gamer represents a small fraction of the mass shooters and why the overwhelming majority of kids that are gamers do not commit any acts of violence.
That's true. But the Buffalo guy, he was streaming that mass murder live on his gaming channel.
So what? What
well,
does that tell you?
Watching that, I felt like it was in a bad video game.
Okay. And that anecdote tells you what about any policy related to mass shooters or public safety?
It's a fraction of the people.
Doesn't tell you anything.
Video game. Right.
That's the answer. Bob in Edison Park.
Dan, I'm glad you're back because it's funny, when Amy's on, I don't seem to get put on the air. But real quick, going to the red flag laws, I think they're going to get some of these weak-kneed Republicans to go along with pushing some type of red flag law. And the general concern, I think, for all of us should be, who decides? I mean, who is good? Is it going to be Facebook fact checkers? Is it going to be that woman from the Department of Truth or whatever they called it? Who is going to decide who actually is mentally ill? I mean, if you post something that they consider violent, are you then, in fact, on a red flag law? And one quick other point, wow. You know, the founders of this country were all farmers and businessmen. So Darren Bailey, I mean, I think that's a compliment rather than a crack.
I agree. Thanks for the call. I mean, the red flag laws, you know, I mean, these have to be judicial proceedings and you have to have due process for the target of the deprivation of a right. And that's the only way. And that's so that's fine in particular circumstances. If a family member moves, if they can't go out cooperation from a family member or they are aware of an imminent threat, law enforcement, school personnel. Yeah, right. Well, that's why we have courts of law. And that's why we have due process. So you follow it in these instances. And if there's an imminent threat, then there are judicial bypasses to deal with an imminent threat. And that's how you do it, just as you would any other exigent threat to the public order in any other context. Elliot Wilmette.
Hello. Dan, Amy.
Hello.
How you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm not,
I'm okay. I'm hoping we can beat the Democrats back in the national elections with our own LGBT, which, of course, is love, guns, bacon, and Trump.
There you go.
Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call, Elliot. Eduardo at Midway with a movie review for the weekend.
Well, I didn't actually go see it, just other than the preview, but you can't beat a supporting cast of Tom Skerritt, Michael Ironside, Kelly McGillis, and then Tom's acting like he's like 27 again, so that's weird. So forget about it. Stick to the original.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I was going to say, wait, is Tom Skerritt in the sequel? I mean, he is. He's still alive.
He's still alive?
He's like 90 years old.
What about the love interest? Is she still there, Kelly McGinnis?
She's not in the movie, right? Don't I have that right?
I can't imagine. You know, well, she has a cameo somewhere.
I'll tell you what. I'll make a movie recommendation since Eduardo at Midway failed us. And he brought up Tom Skerritt, a movie that came out last year featuring Tom Skerritt. I mean, again, he's in his late 80s at least. East of the Mountains. East of the Mountains. Check it out in one of the streaming. It's good.
Okay.
Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Dan and Amy, you've both been doing a great job, I think, on analyzing the debates and so forth with the governor's race. And but I think, though, Dan, you could go a little further since, you know, you were a candidate in 2010. And you might be able to give us some insights into what, say, Bailey was thinking when Urban said so-and-so. Like, because, you know, you faced five candidates. You faced Adam Andrzejewski, and he was always talking about spending. And Schillerstrom was always apologizing for being pro-choice. Brady was always talking about cutting taxes and running his family business. What was Jim Ryan talking about? He was talking about his experience.
What was Kirk Diller talking about? And you have to say it in Kirk Diller's voice.
Well, you know, I think he said something like, I will serve as Jim Edgar's chief of staff. What was going through your mind, Dan, when, because he said that every time. I served as Jim Edgar's chief of staff. What was going through your mind when he kept saying that? Because, you know, I was at most of these events with you. I was there. You know, you were always talking about how Illinois is fixed. Great, great one-liner.
You know what was going through my mind through most of that campaign?
What was going through your mind?
If you've watched Arrested Development, you know the Will Arnett character, Job.
I believe so. I saw parts of that show.
Yeah, and he has sort of a recurring line when he gets into a bit of a pickle where he said, I've made a terrible mistake. And that was going through my mind for most of that campaign.
Really?
Thanks for the call, Frank.
Life experience.
Chuck and Delavan.
Chuck, yes.
Hey. I want to tell everybody, thanks for coming up here to Lake Geneva last weekend. Otherwise, it'd be like a ghost town. It was packed. All kinds of dancing. I went Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. All the restaurants were full. You guys were spending money like there was no end. So thank you very much. Come back up tomorrow, too. There's plenty of dancing and plenty of restaurants tomorrow, too.
Thanks, Chuck.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.